Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 24th of July, 2013. Nav Briefing 75, the Turton's Recapitulation. Just want to say that I'm starting this recording under some unusual conditions today due to work being done on the local electrical trunk. There's no electricity in the house from about 8:30 in the morning to sometime early in the afternoon. Now, granted, there's never very much electricity in this house anyway. There's no visible electrical line running to this house. There is an underground line, which is nothing more than an extension cable from another house. So the entire electricity of this house is run on an extension cord. And I've taken the antenna off the Wi-Fi, and I don't use the Wi-Fi in the house, so I don't have a shortwave presence as far as that goes. Although there is a shortwave signal that comes from a repeater 6 miles away. That is the signal that carries the internet to the chicken wire antenna on my roof. So you could say that on an average day, I'm fortunately exposed to a relatively low dose of electricity and shortwave radiation. This is one of the advantages of living off the grid or on the edge of the grid, as the saying goes. But I have to tell you that when they turn the electricity of the whole trunk off, I can really feel it. And it feels really nice. So I was sitting on the terrace this morning with Rumi just after they turned it off around 8:30. And for about half an hour, I sat there and watched the little lambs run around down on the hillside. And I think for those of us who are still alive in the electromagnetic sense, those of us who still have a geo-electromagnetic bond to the body of the animal mother, I think that for animals such as that, there's a palpable feeling when electricity is no longer present in the ambient setting. Now I'm just recording on my Mac. I've got 67% of the battery power left. But I thought I'd begin this recording in this ambience because it feels sweet and comfortable. Sweet and easy. And that is the way I like it. All things sweet and easy. So, the Turton's recapitulation, what am I getting at here? Well, part of what I intend to say in this briefing comes from a little exercise of recapitulation that I am doing right now. And I'm doing it by hand. And the occasion of doing this recapitulation is closely related to being without electricity for 5 or 6 hours a day, therefore not being at the computer, therefore not being wired in to the electronical system of IT and the whole nine yards of our quantic technology. This particular feat of recapitulation is something I haven't done before. You know, those who read Castaneda over many years are fully aware of the exercise of recapitulation undertaken by sorcerers at different times in their life. Castaneda gives elaborate accounts of that practice. As far as I can recall, the most elaborate one was conducted under the direction of Florinda in one of the later books. Florinda, beautiful name. And a woman named Florinda Donner does actually exist and wrote a number of books about the Neo-Taltic sorcery that are well worth reading. Her first book, The Witch's Dream, ought to be with you at all times. And if you were stranded proverbially on a desert island, rather than having the Bible or Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species to read, you would do well to have The Witch's Dream by Florinda Donner. So anyway, the recapitulations can be done in various ways and with various objectives. Let me tell you how I am doing this recapitulation. In the flow of the momentous events that are now transpiring since July 7th, when the Aeon Sophia coordinated her first and second attentions and made a breakthrough into the human mind, and since the inception of the Vajra Yogini shift a couple of days later, in the course of these events, I find myself looking back to 5 years ago. It was, in fact, July 21st, 2008, when I experienced what I call the Rhonda moment. So I had the occasion a few days ago to observe the fifth anniversary of the Rhonda moment from July 21st, 2008 to July 21st, 2013. And I took that occasion to undergo a little shamanic investigation in the presence of my apprentice. And that is an event that I may describe in the course of this briefing as well. Now, curiously, this current recapitulation has a particular form. It has a ratio. It's based on a ratio. That ratio is 64 years to 64 months. So in December of 2008, I turned 63, or I completed 63 years. So I really entered my 64th year in 2008, right? So I associate 2008 with the number 64. And lo and behold, if I go back to the initial conditions for the delivery of the Terma of Gaia Awakening, I find that it occurred 64 months ago. So I'm contemplating the 64 years of my life as they have been poured forth and compressed into the 64 months from April 2008 until July 2013. That is more or less the way the recapitulation has designed itself in my mind. So I'm going back over 64 months, and the inception point of this recapitulation is Sunday, April 6th, 2008. And the notation in the recapitulation calendar, there are two notations. There are three columns. There's a column of the dates, a column of the events, and a column of the code that goes with those events. The code being the lunar apogee or perigee, the Dakini shift, or other lunar, planetary, or sidereal events that define the timing of those events. Lunar sidereal phenomena which constitute a code. So, the dates, the events, and the celestial code corresponding to those events. This is how I'm doing the recapitulation. Now, I'll tell you something that you might find a little bit odd. I found it odd. I realized when the impulse to do this recapitulation came up that I didn't have a clear idea of the exact sequence of Dakini shifts during those critical months of 2008 that led to my receiving the Terma of Gaia Awakening on the 8th of August. So I thought, wow, I think I'll just go back and look. That would be really fun. I probably knew at some point, but now, in order to establish this recapitulation on precise conditions, I would like to know precisely how the Dakini shifts fell relative to those decisive events of 2008. And of course, the first thing I looked at was that day, Sunday, April 6th. That was the day that Emma sat right here in this room where I'm standing now and folded. You know, to say someone folded, Emma folded, is a Kalika slang from gaming metaphor, isn't it? You fold in a game of cards. You hold or you fold. Hold them or fold them. And I might suggest, just for your pleasure and entertainment, that you go to Google and look up, go to YouTube and pull up The Gambler by Kenny Rogers, especially in the version he did with the Muppets. And listen to The Gambler. It's one of the great songs of that era, and truly a song that is absolutely packed with Kalika wisdom, based on the theme, you got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. You got to know when to walk away and know when to run, and so forth. So Emma folded on that day, and that's when my initiation began, the Kalika initiation that led to Tongue on Knife, that led to the Rhonda moment, that led to the discovery of the Terma of Gaia Awakening. So what were the conditions of the code of the celestial events reflecting that moment? Well, the astrological ephemera shows that on April 6, 2008, there was a new moon in 17 degrees of the sign Aries, which is in the fishes. And that new moon occurred almost exactly at the hour of the last encounter I had, or the critical encounter I had. It wasn't the last encounter, but it was the last moment of the relationship. Everything after that was wreckage. That moment corresponded almost to the hour, to that new moon. The new moon of that Sunday defined the end of the Swandeva shift and the beginning of the shift of Chinnamasta, whom we now call Mirita. Remember that Chinnamasta is the self-beheading Mahavidya. So, a day or so after that moment, that Sunday, on Monday or Tuesday of that week, when my ordeal was getting well underway, the crescent moon appeared in the constellation of the Ram, indicating the shift of Chinnamasta. You know that the self-beheading motif, among other things, represents a massive emotional catastrophe that may befall you in the process of ego death. And certainly that was the case. I had the image of a wrecking ball, you know. Emma's act was like a wrecking ball that hit my ego. And it was a shattering event of the kind that can occur under the particularly grueling instructions of that Mahavidya, Chinnamasta. So how significant? Not only that, but the exact position of the new moon on that day was just a degree or so off from the apsides of Jupiter. Do you remember the saying? The correction of the Aeon Sophia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter. And so that was the key moment. That was the initial moment. And what I observed as I continued to track the lunations forward was that the next lunation occurred On the 5th of May, in 16 degrees of Taurus, of course, that's in the ram, in the middle of the ram. So that was the lunation that marked the end of the Trinamasta shift and the beginning of the double shift of Bhudevi and the wrathful green Tara, the selector. Key events occurred immediately also in the first days of that shift. And there was a decisive confrontation and a farewell moment that took place in Rwanda at the Queen Victoria Hotel, the Reina Victoria, which is a 5-star or 4-star hotel in Rwanda, overlooking the gorge, overlooking the mountains to the west. That's the hotel where Rilke once stayed. In fact, they have kept the room where he stayed as it was when he was there. And there's a statue of Rilke in the park there. Rilke was also born on the Antares Aldebaran axis, as I was. So, wow, it's like not only did the first immediate download from Trinamasta coincide to the traumatic inception of my initiation, but the second download coincided with another key moment. And from that moment on, the 5th of May onward, into June, to the beginning of June, I was certainly in the throes of a selection process under the direction of the wrathful green Tara. There was an enormous amount of wrath coming through me, let me tell you that. There was murderous wrath coming through me during that month. And I don't think I could have lived if I hadn't allowed that wrath to come up and if I hadn't recognized it and honored it. And so at the same time that I began to mine the treasure and beauty and abundance that was coming from this initiation, and mind you, I didn't even know I was in the initiation yet. At the same time I was mining the abundant richness of it, I was blazing with wrath. And I was facing the question of selection in many ways. I remember very well that I was facing the question of selection in this way. Well, can I love again? You know? Because, you know, love is a choice. And I selected Emma to love her. When she appeared, I said, okay, I select her. And I thought, will I ever select anyone again? Or like, this was over the top. I can't match this. And that was one way in which the selection theme played powerfully into the events of May of that year. And there are many other ways as well. I was in the underworld. I was Orpheus in the underworld at that time. And the underworld, or the Plutonic realm, is a realm of tremendous richness and beauty. There are occult powers. There are lost treasures. There are lost civilizations in the underworld. And I was down there, deep in the underworld, in my role of Orpheus. The myth of Orpheus and Eurydice is intimately connected with the constellation of the Scorpion and the Scorpio-Taurus axis. So I was plunged deep into my personal slash transpersonal myth by this event. And I lived through that during the month of May under the instruction of those two Dakinis. Then it came to about the 4th of June, and the new moon fell on that date in 14 degrees of Gemini. Well, as you know, that would be in the forehead of the bull regarding the stellar zodiac or real sky constellations. So that new moon event indicated the end of the shift of Bhudevi and the wrathful green Tara. And the crescent moon that appeared a couple of days later on the 5th or 6th of June was in the constellation of the twins. Hence, the shift went to Idris, formerly known as Bagalamukhi. And you know that Idris is the mistress of fate. So I didn't know at that time that the sunset crescent in the twins represented the shift of Idris, nor did I even know she was called Idris. nor could I have called her the mistress of fate. And yet, that Dakini that Mahavidya was at that moment, conducting my fate and showing me how to change fate. And the first thing that I realized under that instruction, although I realized it, you would say, okay, fair enough, unconsciously or subconsciously, was that I could change my fate by changing the mythic narrative in which my fate was inscribed. Well, the mythic narrative that describes my fate is, of course, the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, as just explained. In the first moments of the Idris shift, the 5th or 6th of June of that year, I had just returned from visiting someone in Hamburg. I was at my friend Chantal's home in Flanders, and I remember clearly, and I have marked on the calendar, what a beautiful summer day it was. I was sitting there around 11 o'clock in the kitchen, eating some piece of toast from the bread that comes from the bakery in town, stone oven baked bread, and having a slice of ham on my toast and drinking some coffee. And as I looked out on the backyard, I realized that this was the moment to go upstairs and rewrite the end of the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. And so I just walked up the stairs and opened my computer, and I wrote it with nary a forethought. I had no idea how I was going to change the end of the myth until I came to the end. I described the events as if they were current in front of my eyes, the meeting of Orpheus with Persephone and Hades, their conversation at dinner, and everything that transpired in real time and in the immediacy of the present moment. And I just wrote it down. You could say that Idris was there looking over my shoulder. You could say certainly that the mistress of fate was directing me in a change of narrative. Change the narrative and you change the events driven by the narrative. And I wanted to change the outcome of that myth because I couldn't bear losing my Eurydice. And that was the way that I enacted the instruction of Idris at that moment, even though I didn't know it was Idris. And I hadn't made the correlation between constellation and Mahavidya, nor had I renamed that Mahavidya from its original name, which is Bagalamukhi, the one who holds the bridle, which is the bridle of fate. As you know, the instructions of Idris concern matching. They concern the conjoined fate of two human animals. Therefore, they concern great stories of love, passion, as well as stories of separation. So there that was, the beginning of June. And then it was about 3 weeks later that I went up on the ridge, 24th of June, still during the shift of Idris, for yet another decisive event. I thought I was doing due diligence of a tertan to go up there and have a little conversation with Gaia by asking her the question, how do those devoted to your ways, devoted to your designs and purposes, find their way through the coming extinction? You remember I wrote about that on MetaHistory. It was called Gaia Responds to a Sane Human Witness. And she told me, write the epitaph of humanity, perished due to failure to observe beauty. And then I got whacked by you-know-who. My sweet guardian, Kali Ma, hit me right between the eyes. The serpent power of the ridge. The telluric Shakti surged up beneath the Deve tree and electrified my entire mind. And I stood there, stunned, to learn that I had been taken into an initiation process on April 6th. And my guardian explained to me exactly what this process was about, and she said it would last 108 days until July 21st. Well, that happened during the shift of Idris. So then we come around to the 1st of August, 2008, just under 5 years ago, okay? Remember, 5 years is 5 times 12 is 60 months, right? And if you add the 4 months from April, it's 64 months. It so happens that in that fateful year, the lunation marking the next Dakini shift fell on the first day of the month. So the first day of July, in calendrical time, corresponded to the first day of the new shift. The new moon occurred in 10 degrees of Cancer. Well, of course, that's in the lower torso of the twins. What does it signify? The completing moment of the shift of Idris correlated to the twins. 40-odd hours later, the sunset crescent appears in the constellation of the crab, signal of the shift of Tantra Mother or Vajrayogini. So in the very first days of July, as I was grappling to come to terms with this initiation process into which I had been plunged without knowing it, I entered the Vajrayogini shift. And 21 days later, which would be the 21st day of the Vajrayogini shift, that is to say the day of the hinge of the solution, remember, I experienced the Rhonda moment, 2:42 p.m. on Monday, July 21st, 2008. So that event occurred during the Vajrayogini shift of that year, 5 years ago. Now, we come to the next Dakini shift. Once again, interestingly, the new moon fell on the first day of the calendar month. So, August 1st was the first day of the new shift, marked by the moon, new moon in 10 degrees of Leo. Well, you know, that is in the constellation of the crab. What does it indicate? Completion of the shift of Vajrayogini. The crescent moon that appears on the 2nd or 3rd of August was the crescent moon of Bhairavi. And on the 8th of August, which was the 8th day of that shift, the day when the first quarter moon appears, I received the Terma of Gaia awakening. Note that there are 18 days from July 21st, the Rhonda moment, till August 8th. And note also that the sunset crescent in the first days of August of 2008 would have been visible in close proximity to the star Regulus in the constellation of the Lion. I later determined that the constellation of the Lion correlates to Bhairavi. That was part of the content, that correlation was part of the content of the terma. It was implicit in the terma on August 8th when I received it, but only became evident when I unfolded the terma, as it were, when I sat down to expand it into a receivable form. Then the correlation fell into place. The star Regulus that marks the heart of the Lion may better be called by another name, Vira. Star Vira represents the heroic spirit of the human animal. And that heroic spirit is not gender biased. You know, vira, the Sanskrit root V-I-R, it's an Indo-European root, is the root of the word virile, sure. But it's also the root of the word virago, which means a woman of power. It's also contained in the word virgin, V-I-R. So virility is a male aspect of the heroic quality of vira. But that heroic quality is not confined to men. It is exhibited equally by both genders. In some respect, I understand now, looking back over 5 years and 64 months, that the Terma of Gaia Awakening is the heroic declaration of the liberation of humanity from the enemies of humanity and from the illusions and deceits which are weapons against human potential and weapons against the beautiful opportunities of this divine experiment. Planetary Tantra is an heroic undertaking. It's an heroic calling. And look how that calling has unfolded. I had no idea, even when I was developing the formal elements of the Terma in September and October of 2008, I had no idea of the role of the Kalika War Party. It was actually with you, members of the GNE, that I realized in real time what is the Kalika War Party and how it is so necessary to define the formations, the seven ranks of the war party, so that each individual finds his or her role in this heroic undertaking, in this war, which is the completion of the war of Kurukshetra that was described in the Mahabharata and in the Bhagavad Gita, the war that was interrupted at the beginning of Kali Yuga in 3102 BC and now comes to be completed. The undertaking of that heroic mission is absolutely implicit in the Terma of Gaia Awakening. I've come to understand that many times over in the past couple of years since this experiment got running. As you know, I felt it necessary in the beginning to firewall Kalika war intel from the procedures of the GNE. But as time went by, I found out that it was impossible to do that. Just let me recapitulate and restate one point before I move on to the rest of this briefing. No one in the GNE is obliged to undertake lethal strategies of the Kalika War effort, as it were, as it might be called. The strategies of the Kalika War Party do include lethal strategies, but no one is obliged to undertake them. What you are obliged to do is support those who do undertake them. That is a requirement. And I can state that now with confidence. If you can't defend yourself, then at least respect those who are willing to defend you and perhaps even give their lives for you. This is an old truth that belongs to the heroic path of life. And it's a truth to be lived, recovered, and lived today in many, many ways. So that's a 35-minute point. I think I'm going to stop now for a while. I'm going to continue my recapitulation. while the electricity is off. And then I'll pick up and conclude the last 45 minutes of this briefing a little later in the day. Greetings, crew. So here I am back again. It's not later in the same day, actually a couple of days later. The electricity problems in the region got fixed, and I continued with my recapitulation under ordinary conditions. What I would like to do is, ordinary conditions of exposure to electricity, I mean, what I would like to do in the completion of this briefing is to, first of all, point out the takeaway of my account of my recapitulation so far. Right now, I'm living through a pretty poignant moment in my life. These are the 18 days between the 21st of July and the 8th of August. And I find that now at the 5-year anniversary point that I have a lot of emotion in my body. I'm carrying a lot of emotion right now, and it's really hard for me to speak, actually. I took occasion to give you an account of my recapitulation as a way to prompt myself to start speaking. As you know, and whether you believe it or not, it is true, it's not a posture, I don't really care to talk about myself that much. In fact, before the experiences of 2008, I never did ever talk or write about myself or disclose any part of my personal biography. So, the preceding part of this briefing gets about as close as I care to get to personal disclosure, referring to the events of that momentous summer in my life. Yet, there's something about those events that's, I venture to say, not just about me, you know, alone. And that's why I sometimes go back to them and sometimes relate them over and over again from a different perspective. But what I would like to say now as a takeaway of the foregoing remarks is that the Terma of Gaia awakening came to this world during a Bhairavi shift. I want to highlight that fact to your mind. It came on the 8th calendar day, which was the 8th day of the Bhairavi shift, which happened to be the 8th of August, 2008. There's a lot of 8s in there, a lot of infinities. And I just want to say that today is what, you know, coming upon the hinge here in a few days. The hinge of the Vajrayogini shift, I believe, is on Tuesday. I'm speaking to you on a Friday evening. And then, after 7 more days, a Bhairavi shift. Just want you to be alert and to be vigilant to this timing. The other thing I'd like to say about electricity goes like this. You know, I don't really know if I could tell if someone switched off the electricity here and then I was put in a test situation to see if I could tell when it was off and when it was on. I probably couldn't. I can say that I feel something physically and in my nervous system when it's off, but I knew it was off. Suppose I didn't know it was off. Can I tell that the electricity goes off in my house without having to go switch on a light which does not work before I know it? No, I can't. I can't claim that, but I might be close to it. And there's something else that I would claim. I would claim that in the near future, some human animals will indeed be able to do that. Some probably are already able to do that. But I would also point out that there are some human animals walking around on this planet, which would be the vast majority of human animals, who will never, ever be able to do that. And I'd like to tell you exactly why. The reason is due to the archontic intrusion into the bioelectromagnetic field of the Earth. They make this intrusion by having humans do their dirty work for them. Since archons cannot, in fact, land on the lawn of the White House, and they cannot sustain any period of time in the atmosphere, because oxygen is toxic to them, to their systems. They get other human animals to create the technology that allows them, by proxy, to have a vicarious presence in the biosphere. Now, I can remember when I had a little place in Santa Fe off Palos Avenue before I got my larger place. At La Vereda, I had a little place, and I can remember that that was the first place that I ever owned what was quaintly called in those days a touch-tone telephone. So when I got a phone line installed there, they offered me a little red phone with touch tones. Previous to that, I'd always used a dial phone. That was the first step in our archontic incursion. Instead of dialing, inserting my finger in a mechanical device and dialing, I just pressed a button and heard a tone. Second step came with more and more buttons. More and more buttons and electronic devices operated by buttons. So humanity was shifted into the fate of being a button-pushing species by the IT innovations that proceeded from the 70s onward. Next step was the mouse. The mouse with its little tail running to the computer, and you rolled the mouse around, you tactily and manually manipulated the mouse and clicked the mouse. So the mouse click replaces and advances the touch tone push. You're not pushing a touch tone anymore, you're clicking a mouse, and you're tactily holding that mouse in your hand. Next step became the mouse pad, this device that you have on your computer, wherein you touch with your finger, and it functions like a mouse. Then we came to the current step. And you know what that is, don't you, me mateys? How many people did I see at Brussels International Airport? How many people did I see on the plane, including little Sophie sitting beside me and her brother, the woman sitting in front of me? How many people did I see as soon as I got off the plane at Malaga Airport? And what were they all these people doing? They were groping the archons. They were touching screens. Now, I would like to know if there's anyone else on this planet besides John Lash who has wondered about conducting an experiment. First, to go back to Wilhelm Reich and read Reich's book about his experimentations with the electrostatic charge of human skin and human touch, and the electrostatic charge and discharge of the orgasm, and so forth. Go back and review Reich's studies. It's there. It's in a book titled, hold on, The Bioelectrical Investigation of Sexuality and Anxiety. Upon reviewing Reich's studies and upon looking at the YouTube clips which show the devices that he invented, wherein a person could put their hand upon one of these devices and cause an electrical discharge that would actually run a machine. Upon reviewing that, How about conducting an experiment that goes like this? You wire 10 different people up to a device that records the electrostatic discharges on their skin, and then you record what happens when they touch computer screens. And I would venture to say that the electrostatic potential of the skin drops every time a finger touches one of those screens, and that it drops even more sharply when a finger runs across the screen. The touch screen technology invented by human animals on this planet is the last frontier of the human archons to steal the electromagnetic vitality that is endowed in us as members and participants of Sophia's dreaming. Bear in mind, my friends, that her dreaming is a geo-electrical magnetic phenomenon. It is not merely an act of imagination. It is imagination operating bio-electromagnetically. And the aeons operate through these kinds of currents within the experiments that they project from the pleromic center. The archons inhabiting our solar system want to intrude upon this electronic dream medium. And their ultimate frontier for doing it, apart from wiring your sorry ass up to a virtual reality device and turning you into a battery, as shown in the film Matrix, their ultimate assault is through touch screen technology. So I'm pretty certain that the 10 individuals in that experiment would show a drop of electrostatic potential across the membrane of their skin, the skin boundary. But they would show it in different ways, and the differences would indicate those individuals who have more or less resistance to being depleted by IT. So I would advise you, do not touch screens. And if you're going to use a computer, do not use a mouse pad. Use a mouse attached by a mouse's tail into a USB outlet in a computer, if you're lucky enough to find a computer that will still accept that technology, and if you're lucky enough to find a plug-in mouse, which is not easy to find these days. I also want to point out, just as the stinger in the tail, you know how it is, coming from a shaman born in the scorpion, I always like to give you a little stinger in the tail. Reich observed, and wisely so, and ever so correctly so, that the electromagnetic component of the human body is concentrated in a particular way in saliva. Do you ever wonder why kisses are thrilling? Do you ever wonder why open mouth French kissing is such a kick? In Tantra, everything begins with a kiss. If there is not an electrical exchange in the kiss, then there is no tantric sex to follow from that act. That is the meaning of the word, the tantric kiss. In Kala Tantra, the rituals of magic use electrically charged bodily fluids, including saliva. In Planetary Tantra, you use your blood, which contains iron, to effectuate your bond with the planetary animal mother at the same moment that you give her your intention in the Gayan Tantric vow, right? In Kala Tantra, you do it all through saliva and bodily fluids. And while I'm on the subject, excuse me, Mamacita, but I may as well add the gruesome and dirty truth that those human animals on this planet who are most deeply infected with the archonic virus show it by the fact that they have a large component of nasal mucus in their saliva, and you can hear it in the way they speak. You can also detect it by their body odor, which is an odor of mucus. In fact, you could say, well, I'm going to say it right now, so here goes, that the archontic intrusion upon this planet, effectuated through the so-called ancient Hebrews, is really based on an infection in sinusoidal mucus. Even the archonic intrusion is material. Everything is material. That is a principle of Maya Vadavedanta. Now, to switch with that same thought in mind, everything is material, to a more positive note, let me tell you something about the weather recently in my part of the world. I recounted in my little series of travelogues from Flanders that there were 3 days of absolutely impeccable sky over Belgium, over Brussels, to be precise. And I recounted that these 3 days corresponded to the moment of Sophia's Magnificat. Remember that? I'm beginning to wonder, what is Sophia's Magnificat? Is it something that we are going to wait to be revealed with some expectations that may be fulfilled, some expectations that may be disappointed, some expectations that may be fantastic and unreal and not based on the true imagination? What is this Magnificat of July 7th, 2013? Well, I've been back here for a while now, and I have to say that I can testify to at least 5, maybe 7 or 8 days here in Andalusia when there was not one single cloud in the sky and not one single trace of any kind of atmospheric activity, certainly not the trace of a chemtrail, not even the trace of fine cirrus clouds or tissue clouds, nothing but a crystal clear dome of sky. Now, I must add, that the color of the dome of the sky here is tending more toward a powdery blue than it did when I first came here. It's tending more away from an intensely blue turquoise to a paled out powdery blue. I do detect that difference. And I would say, without question, that difference in the overall luminal aura of the sky dome may well be due to an input of chemicals into the atmosphere by certain human animals who are practicing what is called geoengineering. So I would detect that. I cannot deny that. But at the same time, I have to tell you what's happening here. And I have to insist, or let you make your own conclusion. I won't insist, but I have to propose the question. Is this physically explicable? It is very hot here right now in southern Spain. It is like 80 in the shade through the afternoon. But I have noticed since the beginning of summer that there is a cool underlayer of wind. And so I can sit out on the terrace like I was just an hour ago at 3:30, feeling the heat. I'm under the shade that I constructed on my upper terrace, feeling the heat. And within the total ambiance of summer heat, the wafting of a cool breeze. I mean, where is this cool breeze coming from? Is this cool breeze coming from Sophia's Magnificat? Now, I also have noticed, and this has been confirmed by someone who lives not too far away, an Ambergane house, that there are no airplanes to be seen in the sky. Now, I am used to seeing airplanes from where I live. They never fly directly over my house, but they fly off to the east, off to the west, and they fly right to left and left to right across the horizon line, across the boundary line between Africa and Europe, which is due south of me. I know all these flights by heart. There are the crossover flights, like, say, from Paris down to Casablanca. There are flights along the coast of the Mediterranean. There are the flights, the international flights, out of Malaga Airport, out of Madrid Airport. And in particular, there are two flights that I have been accustomed to watch all through the summer in previous years. I suppose that these flights come from the Canary Islands, Tenerife, or something like that, because south southwest, is typically two contrails that form like a big V, and they originate from that direction of the horizon, and they form a V, and one of them, I suppose, is the contrail of planes from the Canary Islands going to, who knows, Rome, Marseille, whatever. And the other one is the one going to either Malaga or Madrid or other points north. Simple enough. Predictable, routinely scheduled tourist flights that go out through the summer in the evening. The evening tourist flights from the Canary Islands. Well, where are they? There are no flights. There's no airplane anywhere. I can sit out on my terrace for 6 hours and I see no airplane. Now I ask you again, and I ask myself. I pose this question. How subjective is this experiment? This is what I want to know. This is a question to investigate now intensely in this concluding phase of the GNE. How subjective is this experiment? According to the syntax of her dreaming, how much subjective reality can happen that overrides what we call objective reality? Because it is not consistent with objective reality that I can sit on my terrace for hours during the day or in the early evening at the height of tourist season in Europe and not see a single airplane. But that is the fact of what's happening. Now, when I let my mind go back to 5 years ago, I have an acute memory of the 18 days between the Rhonda moment and receiving the term of Gaia Awakening. I came back from Rhonda that day, that Monday, and I was truly in a manic state of divine ecstasy. But I was calm. I was calm. I was serene, and I was happier than I had ever been in my life. As a matter of fact, it was the first moment in my life that I broke through into total and complete happiness. Happiness came late to me in life. It came to me that day in Rhonda, and it came to stay. And in the subsequent days, I couldn't do anything. I was so stunned. I was so caught up in the beauty of this world as it is in her dreaming,
I was so floored by the cognitive ecstasy of that moment that showed me how the universe hungers after its own beauty. And this is what drives everything. The hunger of the universe to see and realize its own beauty. It's the only mechanism of the entire countless billions of galaxies. It's nothing but that. And I was carried along by this realization to the point where I was reduced to a childlike helplessness. I sit out here on this terrace in the very place I just sat this afternoon as I was writing down a few notes for this talk. And I sat there, and the sky was green, and it was raining a crystalline dew, which is called the rain of wisdom. And I just sat there in the rain, like a wide-eyed child. And there were so many things that happened leading to that moment when I received the terma. So many magical events during those 18 days. Many, many times the vultures came in groups and they spiraled in these columns over my house. The vultures came to visit me over and over again. And they spiral in these thermals. 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 of them spiraling in these thermals that go so high that the vultures disappear like specks into the blue. And among those vultures, there was one vulture who caught my attention. And I know that she was a young vulture, maybe 2.5 to 3 years old, because you can tell how old they are by the size. And like all those other vultures, she has on the upper part of her wings a kind of beige or buff color that glints in the sunlight when the vulture turns, when the vulture planes in a thermal. Without moving its wings, it turns and you catch this light that flashes off the buff color, the top of their wings. And I saw that in that buff color, there was a reddish stain, like dried blood. This is how I observed this vulture. And when I saw that this vulture had that tint of dried blood in the color of her wings, that vulture separated from the spiraling group. And that vulture flew in a way intended to show me that she was a particular vulture. And the way she flew is not a way that I have ever seen any other vulture fly. You know, when you see a raptor bird like a peregrine falcon or an owl dive, it dives and plunges in a straight line. Sometimes the plunge is quite vertical. Peregrine falcon can plunge at 240 miles an hour vertically. Did you know that? But sometimes there is a straight, long, straight plunge. And vultures don't do that, but this one did. It took a long, straight plunge across the horizon whenever it caught my eye. But it wasn't plunging for anything. Normally, they plunge more vertically when there is carrion in the fields. I've seen them do it. Not only did this vulture catch my eye, but she flew for me. And I sat on a terrace under the green sky in a fractal emanation of Dakini powers and watched my vulture fly for me. How subjective is this experiment? I would say to you now, if I want to give you syntax, the narwhal provides syntax, right? I would say, here's the relevant syntax. That vulture was the Nirmanakaya manifestation of my sacred guardian among the Gayan Dakinis, Kali. It was the manifestation of Kali in the real objective world as a vulture. At that time, I was completely alone here in this little house, as I still am on many days and nights. And I had occasion to talk to a partner of many years, who is now a former partner, who had some knowledge of Buddhism and who understood me to be a mystical boy from the coast of Maine. And I told her about the Rondex moment. I told her about the magic that I was experiencing hour to hour and day to day. And she asked me about that moment in Rhonda. You know, she understood. She has an understanding, as many people do, or let's say a supposed understanding of what is samadhi, what is enlightenment, what is cosmic consciousness, and so forth. And so she said, well, what is it really like, you know, when that happens? And I said, it builds. It doesn't fade. It builds. That's the mark that it's genuine. The breakthrough into this ecstatic realm of knowing gives you an awareness that builds. And man, I didn't know how true that was at the moment I said it. Because in fact, the moment that I said that on the phone to my friend who was in Santa Fe at that moment, the Rhonda experience was building into the discovery of the term of Gaia Awakening. I want to say in closing this briefing that at the very moment that I was in this ecstasy, I was also in the agony of separation from my Eurydice. I could have gone to her house. She lives 35 minutes from here. Could have driven to her house, showed up at her door, followed her around. Could have called her, could have nagged her. She made the choice to be inaccessible and withdraw from me. She made the choice when she dumped me to not be available for even for communication. And I respected that. I have to say it was the hardest thing I ever did in relation to another human being, because there's nothing that I wanted more than to see her face. There's nothing that I wanted more than to look into her eyes. Those pale eyes, aching blue, color of the ocean where I look to die. I wanted to look into the ocean of her eyes and tell her that all I ever wanted to do was show her how beautiful she is. And that in my romantic enthusiasm, I believed that my love for her could do that. But it couldn't. It couldn't do that. There are many, many things, my friends, that love cannot do. So I would say to you now, if you wish to follow the path of love and to discover and demonstrate all the things that love can do in this magnificent dreaming of Sophia, then learn to discern as well what it cannot do. And I learned that also in that momentous summer. And I recall when I was talking with my friend Joanna of the time in Santa Fe, I tried to describe to her the physical sensation that I had in my body. And I said to her, you know, we really have to, no, it's really come to the point for me, this is the way I put it, it's really come to the point for me where I can't abide these pretenses of spirituality anymore, such as you find in Tibetan Buddhism, and particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, because this was a subject, a topic that had played a certain role in our lives together, Joanna and I, over many years. And I said to her, you know, Joanna, I can't abide it anymore, this ripoff that comes from people selling you what you already have. Do you want to know what the rainbow body is? Well, I'll tell you, speaking from one. And the first thing that I'll tell you is that it is just a natural result of the electrification of your imagination by connection to the electrified dream in which you're living. When that connection happens, and it only happens through ecstasy and the lucidity of a transpersonal non-separation, you acquire the rainbow body. You light up like a rainbow. The Tibetan word for the rainbow body is nirmanakaya. And so there I was that day, sitting on the terrace, watching the vultures, watching the crystalline rain of the Dakinis come down out of the green sky. And I didn't even know what was coming around the bend in the shift of Bhairavi. And likewise, I would say today to you, my allies, my friends, my members of the crew, what is coming around the bend in the shift of Bhairavi? How subjective is this experiment? Sometime a number of months later, in December of 2008, there was an occultation of Venus in the evening sky. The crescent moon, which at that time was about a 4 or 5 day crescent, a beautiful crescent moon, actually passed in front of the planet Venus. The entire moon disk, of course, passed in front of Venus. But when the moon disk had completed its occultation, Venus reappeared at the lower edge of the crescent, and it looked like a diamond earring hanging on a woman's ear. I was sitting here on the terrace watching it. This was on December 1st, 2008. I got so excited that I ran down and jumped into my car and drove up to the gasolinera. It's a Spanish word for a gas station where they sell champagne. It's the only place in town you can buy it. I said, I've got to buy a bottle of champagne so I can sit here and drink champagne while I look at this exquisite occultation of Venus. And I was so excited that I broke my determination not to call Emma. I knew she wouldn't accept a call that came from my cell phone, but I'm good friends with the boys at the gas station, so I said to one of them, give me your cell phone. I want to make a local call. That way she'd answer because she wouldn't know the number. I called her and I said, go outside your door. Go look. There's Venus just emerged from occultation of the moon, and it's hanging like a diamond earring on the lunar crescent. Well, it was a little exercise in stalking, and it worked, because she was caught off guard. She didn't hang up on me, at least. And so that day, or later on, or sometime around that time, I was still playing with what I call the Yeats conversions. This is a set of poems that emerged spontaneously during those months. You know, I've been reading Yeats since I was about 15 or 16. He was my favorite poet in adolescence, W.B. Yeats. And it turned out that under the intense mania of that summer and fall, I found myself transcribing these poems of Yeats, and I called them conversions. And so, relevant to the events I'm describing in this briefing, one poem emerged. It's a conversion of a very well-known poem of William Butler Yeats called Leda and the Swan. And I titled this conversion Dysnomanikaia. And it's a description of what I felt on that day that I saw that occultation of Venus. It's a description of how I kind of settled into the plumes of this ecstasy of electrified imagination. Settled into the plumes. The poem contains an allusion to Hindu mythology, Ananta. Ananta is the name of the many-headed serpent who provides the bed upon which Vishnu sleeps as Vishnu dreams the many worlds, the many experiments with sentient beings. Descending coils, the lithe relay of jewel-beaded scales, the softly trembling man held in the cooling swirl of mystic fire, dual currents, rainbow hues, and silence like a fan of massive feathers spread over the room one afternoon at wintertide in Spain. How can a body laid in that white rush resume its mortal self, its repertoire of human pain, no more alive than an expiring heart that in its last pulsation alone assumes eternity? Broke open heart of presence, a flutter in the jeans, Ananta coiled and floating, no life displayed apart from this Dysnomanikaia, whatever it may be. Wherever now is to be lived, this tremor intervenes.